Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Earlier today at Fenway Park, more than 5,000 immigrants were sworn in as new citizens of the United States. Dennis Reardon, a director at the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, welcomed new citizens and their families to the ceremony.
Our country began its transformation from colony to nation in this city. Today, with your oaths of allegiance, you will undergo a similar process and be transformed into a full member of the American community.
Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano was in attendance. So was U.S. District Court Judge Nancy Gertner. Gertner had the honor of reading the names of some of the countries represented.
Belize, Bolivia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Botswana, Brazil.
While the applause makes it obvious there were quite a few Brazilians in attendance, individuals from 147 different countries were represented at today's ceremony.
My name is Rodrigo Cano. I came from Guatemala. I'm glad the opportunity is coming.
And who else was in attendance on this primary election day? Immigrant advocates with the goal of registering new citizens to vote. Long before the FCC or Tipper Gore, there was a different group out to protect polite society and the minds of innocent youths. It was the New England Watch and Ward Society. And during the late 19th century and early 20th century, the group waged a war in Boston on what it called commercialized vice, meaning gambling and prostitution. But the group also targeted books, including Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass and Upton Sinclair's Oil. Tufts University professor Neil Miller chronicles the rise and fall of the New England Watch and Ward Society in his new book, Banned in Boston, The Watch and Ward Society's Crusade Against Books, Burlesque, and the Social Evil. And he's with us now to talk about the history of the group. Neil Miller, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Sasha. Pleasure to be here.
So, Neil, as you write in your book, the New England Watch and Ward Society was formed in 1878, and it lasted until the 1950s, actually quite a long time. And in those 70 years or so, it was Boston's unofficial, self-appointed moral guardian. Give us a quick description of the mission of the Watch and Ward Society.
Well, the mission of the Watch and Ward was to protect the morals of the city, especially at a time when things were changing radically, when immigrants were coming, when the city was becoming more Irish and less Yankee. So it acted in all sorts of ways. It censored books. It closed down theaters. Burlesque shows were a particular target in the 1930s. It also went after gambling, prostitution, even the lottery. They would shut down church raffles, which they thought were a threat to public morals.
Bingo games could attract bingo, attention.
Oh, bingo, definitely. And I've got a passage about how they closed down a poker game at noon, the workers who were building South Station were playing poker during their lunch break, and the Watch and Ward got the police to go in there and break it up and arrested the men. So they were active on all sorts of fronts.
You open your book with a scene that took place in 1926. It's an encounter at the Park Street Church in Boston, right near Park Street Station, what is now Park Street Station, between the famous newspaper editor H.L. Mencken and Reverend J. Frank Chase. Chase was the secretary of the New England Watch and Ward Society. Tell us about that story.
Well, the Watch and Ward, in its censorship activities, the Watch and Ward generally did things behind the scenes. And they almost had a little... you could call it a literary dictatorship in Washington, in Boston. It was called the Gentleman's Agreement, in which the Watch and Ward and a few different booksellers basically decided what could be sold in the city. And H.L. Mencken hated this idea. He was kind of the most famous intellectual figure in America at the time. So he was goading the Watch and Ward into some kind of a confrontation. And Frank Chase unwisely agreed to a little show in which he would sell Mencken, would sell him a copy of Mencken's magazine, The American Mercury, which had been banned by the Watch and Ward. So it all happened on the Boston Common, right next to the Parr Street Church, what was called Brimstone Corner. And there were like 1,000 people there, many of them Harvard students.
And H.L. Mencken basically dared Chase to arrest him because Mencken went out there and tried to sell or did sell his magazine?
Oh, right. And he sold it to Chase for 2 bits. And he was immediately arrested. And everyone assumed that he'd be found guilty of violating the obscenity laws. And Mencken himself was ready to go to prison for a couple of years. But the whole thing backfired, and the judge in the case, whose name was Judge Parmenter, I believe, ruled against the Watch and Ward, which was unheard of in Boston. And that was really the beginning of the decline of the Watch and Ward in terms of its power.
Which we will talk about later. But before we talk about its decline, I feel like as you describe this era in Boston where a bingo game could get vigilante police cracking down on you, I feel like we need you to paint a picture of what Boston was like in those days and whether the city was really a much less upstanding place than it was today. And I wonder if you could read, this is on page 8 of the book that I have in front of me, this description of Boston then. This is at the final paragraph on the bottom of page 8. Could you talk about that, the part about the breakdown of traditional structures?
Sure. Young men and sometimes young women were living alone in large numbers in crowded urban neighborhoods. Boarding houses grew up, and parts of the city like Scully Square and the North End became home to all kinds of less than respectable activities, burlesque shows, penny arcades, tattoo parlors, and cafes that were really fronts for houses of prostitution, the social evil in the euphemism of the day. Pool rooms for registering bets, policy shops that were essentially lotteries, and faro banks where young men would bet a week's wages over a game of cards were rampant. The police and corrupt city officials turned a blind eye to what was going on around them. To the old families, the kingdom of heaven seemed further away by the year.
And of course, people who've been in Boston for many decades will remember the Combat Zone, for example, which looks like nothing that it used to. I mean, now it's all cleaned up. We have a renovated opera house. So at this time, Boston was a little seedier, at least in that area, than it is today.
Yeah, well, the Combat Zone was really the successor to Scully Square, which, as most people know, is where Government Center is today.
And which was sort of the entertainment district.
Right.
The sort of low-budget entertainment district.
Correct.
Exactly. So part of the main goal of the society was basically to uphold the city's decency and suppress obscenity. But, of course, these are very, very subjective things. So how are they defining decency and obscenity?
They basically could define it any way they wanted, and that was the problem. For example, books that they censored, it was never really clear why they censored them because it was all done behind closed doors. So whether it was sex was mentioned as in Whitman's Leaves of Grass, or if there was an attack on the clergy or a mention of the word prostitution, those were kind of the things that went on. If there was a play in which a woman appeared in tights for about 30 seconds, and you know they shut that down. So their version, the Watch and Ward, basically was funded and run by the Boston Brahmins, by some of the most puritanical elements and some of the wealthiest elements in the city of Boston, people like Godfrey Cabot, who was the richest man in Boston, and as you know, the Lowells spoke only to the Cabots, and the Cabots spoke only to God. So he was definitely a real Puritan who was behind them.
You just mentioned Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, which I was hoping you would mention because I pulled out an excerpt from it, because you said that the poem mentioned sex, although I don't know that it actually does explicitly. So let me read the section that I pulled out. This is a poem called A Woman Waits for Me. Now, that's important to keep in mind the context here. The title is A Woman Waits for Me. And it says, I pour the stuff to start sons and daughters fit for these states. I press with slow, rude muscle. I brace myself effectually. I listen to no entreaties. I dare not withdraw till I deposit what has so long accumulated within me. Now, sure, it's sexual, but at least in context of today, that's kind of tame stuff. But back then, was that really not viewed as tame at all?
No, I think it's pretty erotic, but maybe people at that time sort of didn't see it that way. But no, the kinds of books that the Watch and Ward censored, I mean, it's just kind of laughable when you think what's sold on in bookstores these days or things that are said on TV. They were just really proper in our terms today.
There's another excerpt I'd like you to read. It's very close to the one you just read, and it's when a Harvard professor, Dr. Francis Peabody, he's speaking to a group of people about the goal of the Watch and Ward. Could you read that one too?
Yeah.
It's sort of this metaphor for what they thought this obscenity and indecency was doing, and it starts, "We see the great city."
Right. This was an address that he gave on the 20th anniversary of the Watch and Ward. He said, "We see the great city on the surface with all its works and buildings and streets and businesses. And then we remember that under our feet and unseen are miles and miles of pipes from which at any moment there may come up into our faces some pestiferous gas which may creep into our very homes and affect our very dearest with its poison. All the time, therefore, while we go about our daily avocations, the engineers of the city are watching all those pipes, cleansing the sewers, warding the public health." And that, as Peabody saw, was the role of the Watch and Ward. Quote, "quietly, unobtrusively working underground, guarding us from the pestiferous evil which at any time may come up into our faces, into our homes, into our children's lives."
Pestiferous evil. They really thought this stuff was seeping into society, and if they didn't clean it up, it could ruin society. And you write in your book, it's not just the city of Boston. They also targeted naval camps throughout New England, port cities like Portland, Maine, and Newport, Rhode Island, places where military officers were on the prowl and you know, possibly could spread or pick up venereal disease. You quote in your book a Watch and Ward member who says, "It is generally recognized that a bad and diseased woman can do more harm than any German fleet of airplanes." These guys were hardcore.
Right. That was during World War I. Yeah, that was J. Frank Chase.
You mentioned also immigration, and this is an important factor here. You know, they really thought that this wave of immigration had led to a breakdown of moral codes. And it got me thinking, it's really interesting how often immigrants become scapegoats for problems in society.
Right. No, I think that's true. I don't think they were overtly anti-immigrant. It's really missing from their rhetoric. It's far different from today, I might add. But, you know, gambling was associated with the Irish, opium with the Chinese, and one of the things they did was raid opium dens in like 1910, 1915. But I think Protestant Brahmin organization, and, you know, no Irish need apply to be members. I mean, they eventually did, but...
Now, some authors actually found that getting their books banned was great publicity. Upton Sinclair famously said, "I would rather be banned in Boston than read anywhere else, because when you are banned in Boston, you are read everywhere else." So did this, in that sense, did the Watch and Ward's approach backfire because it became great free PR?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Upton Sinclair wrote a book called Oil, which in recent, a couple of years ago, was made into that movie There Will Be Blood, if anybody saw it. And he joked to a friend, he said, you know, whose book had been banned in Boston. He said, "Gee, can you use your connections and try to get mine banned?" Because the book wasn't selling very well. And sure enough, it happened, not necessarily because of his friend. It just did. And Sinclair came to Boston, tried his darndest to get arrested. And it's a very funny part of the book, and even walked around the common with a signboard that said "Oil, the Fig Leaf Edition," and his publisher printed out 150 copies in which the pages that a judge had banned were also blacked out. So he was, and sure enough, sales of Oil went through the roof.
You mentioned earlier that the Watch and Ward Society eventually took a real hit to its reputation. It basically became ruthless in some people's eyes. So what happened that it tilted into this, into basically becoming criminal, which were the things it was trying to outlaw.
Well, it became the thing that really hurt the Watch and Ward was an attempt in 1929 to entrap a Cambridge bookseller at a place called the Dunster House Bookstore. And the Watch and Ward agent got the bookseller to sell him a copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover. And the way it was done really outraged a lot of the morally upright members of the Watch and Ward. And there was a trial. Even the district attorney who was prosecuting it sort of denounced the Watch and Ward. So that was really the beginning of the end. But it stayed on for another 30 years.
Under a different name, sort of a different iteration.
Yeah, in the 50s it changed its name.
Exactly. And that Banned in Boston phrase lasts to this day.
It certainly does.
Neil Miller is the author of Banned in Boston, The Watch and Ward Society's Crusade Against Books, Burlesque, and the Social Evil. He lives in Somerville, and he's a professor at Tufts. We're about to take one more break, but when we come back, an MIT grad comes up with a way to convert dog waste into energy, but implementing the concept has proven more difficult and messy than he ever imagined. Neil Miller, thanks for coming on to Radio Boston and talking about your book.
Oh, my pleasure, Sasha.
Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.